Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll begin reading from the July 2026 issue. First up, Happy Fucking Birthday, An Exhausted America Turns 250 by Christopher Hooks. The Imperial Capital has many beautiful buildings, and they are always kept tidy and clean. They have a quality that grates, though. The landscape is didactic, insistent. Somebody is always trying to teach you something. This is true, of course, of the monuments and museums that are purpose-built to press a vague sense of Republican tradition into generations of American school children on field trips. But there's hardly a pediment or lintel or courtyard in Washington that is not given over to instruction from some half-remembered ancestor. It is a shouty place, and to mixed effect. A hallway in the Capitol building preserves Daniel Webster's immortal proclamation that when tillage begins, other arts follow. Broadly unobjectionable stuff. But was it really necessary, beneath a statue of a wise-looking man at the National Archives, to leave an enjoinder to study the past? And having put that on record, was it also necessary to leave a complimentary warning under a wise-looking woman that what is past is prologue? All this hectoring from the grandfathers, and very occasionally from a grandmother, gets a little more tolerable once you clock how many of these admonitions, exhortations, and commemorations can carry unintended or ironic meanings. The Robert F. Kennedy Department of Justice building, home to an agency that Republicans have long derided as politicized, features an inscription reading, "The place of justice is a hallowed place," alongside blue banners depicting the president looking like a lesser Dick Tracy villain. The other messages flanking the banners are just as mismatched. "Where law ends, tyranny begins," reads one. "No free government can survive that is not based on the supremacy of the law." If true, this is grim news. Law alone can give us freedom, on the other hand, offers a sentiment that our current president would happily embrace. On those same blue banners, Trump is portrayed as the source of all law and promises to make America safe again. A few blocks away is a Commerce Department HQ, named for Herbert Hoover, whose presidency was somewhat famously not particularly good for American commerce. An inscription here comes from Thomas Jefferson, an order from Mr. July 4th himself to cultivate peace and commerce with all. We don't need to belabor that one, except to note that on the day I visited Washington, March 24th, the Strait of Hormuz remained more or less closed, and the Canadian rearmament program was proceeding with some urgency. Even so, Jefferson's directive appeared to have rubbed off on at least one person. Down Pennsylvania Avenue, a man in a karate gi, disposable gloves, and dirty white sneakers was hauling a cart by means of a homemade yoke strapped across his shoulders. An American flag hung from its ropes. The cart was filled with plants he was selling to benefit voiceless children. He was in the middle of the street, occupying a bike lane, and strangers at the crosswalk were, like me, taking pictures and talking about him, as if briefly stunned out of their routines to see a penitent and selfless man in the gleaming city. A year before finding myself outside the Commerce Building, I had set out to read more about the 1976 bicentennial as a way of understanding what might happen to the American mind in 2026. We entered the bicentennial year wearied from unending domestic chaos and debate over the unpardonable sins the country had committed abroad, and on that July 4th, the nation seemed to press the amnesia button. Traditionally cynical and perceptive commentators, not to mention a lot of tired citizens, found themselves, in some accounts, overcome by an unexpected wave of patriotic sentimentality that washed away, at least for a moment, their gnawing doubts. Lost innocence was regained. The amnesia helped make possible both Jimmy Carter's aw shucks presidency and the Reagan Revolution. But the bicentennial took place at a time when the moment of maximum danger for the Republic seemed to have passed. Today, that moment may not yet have arrived. The prospects for the next few years, and the years after those, look pretty bleak. But reading about the bicentennial, I nonetheless wondered whether the amnesia button might be pressed once again, whether we could expect another explosion of warm and fuzzy feelings, and what it might mean for the nation. Privately, I wondered whether I too would be susceptible, and whether I could connect with any remnant of the old faith that I had first picked up from children's books, my parents, and the honorable masters of the Austin Independent School District, or if it would feel all, well, childish. This line of inquiry had brought me to Washington, more specifically to the White House Visitor Center, which is located on the Hoover Building's ground floor, where America 250, the foundation set up by the United States Semi-Quincentennial Commission, was holding a press briefing on the plan for the 100 days leading up to the nation's 250th birthday party, a celebration that had been in the works for a decade. The chair of the commission, Rosa Rios, would speak for an hour to lay out the work that had been done and the wonderful things that awaited the American people in the coming months, during which they would be invited to take stock of where they've been, where they are now, and where they're going, whether they wanted to or not. Rios and her colleagues had gone to great lengths to ensure that this was America's best birthday yet, and they had overcome substantial difficulties to do so. The Semi-Quincentennial Commission was conjured into being by Congress back in 2016, during that long-ago summer when the Democratic Party was convening in Philadelphia and the succession of one form of representational liberalism to another seemed pretty well secure. But the next president and the next Congress were not the folks the political class expected. Somebody had dropped the baton. In the first 2 years of Donald Trump's first term, the majority and minority leaders of the House and Senate appointed 24 commissioners. There were 4 representatives and 4 senators, along with 16 politically connected private citizens, donors, spouses, gadflies, 12 Republicans, 12 Democrats. America 250 would be the commission's public face, a foundation capable of soliciting donations. For the first half of its existence, the commission was a mess. Its first chair was the Philadelphia Trump supporter and real estate executive Daniel DeLella, who was a bit out of his depth. The lawsuits arrived in short order. DeLella and an ally he hired as executive director sued 3 commissioners for defamation. 4 foundation executives brought an employment discrimination lawsuit against DeLella's leadership team. These conflicts raged on through the pandemic, when the country was generally going insane, and in 2022, when President Joe Biden exercised his right to appoint a new chair, Rios took what was, in effect, a thankless cleanup job. The commissioners today have little in common other than the fact that they represent tendencies from an earlier political moment, before the situation had fully ripened. As a result, the body tends toward the old school. One of the commissioners is Joe Crowley, who was famously unseated in his primary by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The 2 actual historians on the commission are Wilfred M. McClay, a George W. Bush appointee to the National Council on the Humanities and a living specimen of the compassionate conservative, and Lucas Morrell, a conservative scholar of Abraham Lincoln at a time when the right's interest in Lincoln is in how his expansive use of war powers might set a precedent for a future American Red Caesar. 2 of the newer members of the commission are the aspiring congressional representative Jack Schlossberg, arguably the country's second-ranking Kennedy, and Kellyanne Conway, a senior advisor to Trump in his first term. There's also the Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, who recently said that her own political party made her feel afraid. From 2 different members, I heard that the commission has rarely had meaningful disagreements, But with a body like this, a lack of meaningful disagreements might suggest that nothing meaningful is actually being discussed. Their unanimity is also somewhat beside the point now that the president has set up his own commemoration bodies, which answer solely to him. The appropriately martial-sounding Task Force 250 and Freedom 250, the latter of which has received funds diverted from America 250. These new bodies seem to be having more success organizing usually deranged events, including a massive military parade in downtown Washington last year, as well as an Indy car race and a UFC fight scheduled for this summer at the White House. Even so, there is one thing Rios wants to make absolutely sure the public understands. America 250 is in perfect alignment with the Trump administration's plans. The duplicate organization, she said, heralded the beginning of a beautiful partnership. Though it felt a little undignified that the bipartisan commission that had toiled for 8 years would be drowned out by the president's own last-minute interference, it might be some consolation that Trump's efforts had also seemed to be derailed. The organizational and administrative bloat that has piled up around the semi-quincentennial can be overwhelming to behold. The president has pledged to prepare for the anniversary such monuments as the Triumphal Arch outside Arlington National Cemetery and the National Garden of American Heroes. Footnote 1. This proposed collection of 250 life-size statues of, among others, Kobe Bryant, Dr. Seuss, and Alex Trebek, a proud son of Ontario who, in 2017, served as an official ambassador for Canada's 150th birthday celebration, originated in Trump's first term but has steadily grown in scope. Recent plans include reflecting pools, an amphitheater, and dining facilities. End of footnote. Neither will be ready by the 4th, of course, and they might never be. The military parade arranged by Task Force 250, which fearful liberals perceived as a dark premonition of the autocracy to come, was decidedly underwhelming as the nation learned together that our soldiers can't march for shit. The low bar that the president is setting gives America 250 the opportunity to bunny hop over it. The rivalry could even be a source of vitality. At the White House Visitor Center, the commission engaged in a bit of boasting of the kind regularly offered by Pete Hegseth at the Pentagon. No one before, Rio said, has ever made the grand declaration that they could engage and inspire 350 million Americans in anything. Another salvo of rekindled patriotic spirit on the way to the hearts of 350 million Americans was downrange and inbound. They were firing danger close. Rios opened her presentation by holding up a yellow, star-shaped plushie with a friendly face. "I am pleased to introduce to you George the Star." The stuffed version of the semi-quincentennial's official mascot, a Nintendo-ish five-pointer, was now available for sale in the Visitor Center's gift shop for $35.95. "This is the first time I'm seeing this plushie, and no one is more excited than I am." George looked like a fine fellow, but there was something just a little off about him. "Aren't the stars on the flag white?" I searched my brain for yellow stars in American iconography, and the closest I could get was the Carl's Jr. logo. Rios then dove into the commission's brand partnerships and social media reach. One of the proudest achievements of the commission, she told us, was Beyoncé's reference to it in an Instagram post. The singer, Rios reminded everyone, had 308 million followers, and thanks to a partnership with Stellantis, the Dutch parent company of Chrysler and Fiat, you can't turn on the TV without seeing a Jeep commercial with our logo on it, which has been amazing. Here, the long-suppressed patriot in me started to experience a sinking sort of feeling. The main reminder I had in my own life that something was worth celebrating this year had been the American flag plastered across cans of Narragansett. But merch ranging from a set of commemorative china at the visitor center to George to semi-quincentennial branded lanyards available exclusively to congressional staffers at their office supply store in the Longworth building doesn't feel like enough to build a country around. To reassure us, Rios provided a comprehensive list of the semi-quincentennial commission's other activities. The most salutary was America's Field Trip, a competition of a familiar kind in which students between 3rd and 12th grade from across the states and territories submit drawings, prose, and essays. Winners are rewarded with a family trip to sites like Yellowstone and Cape Canaveral, and select entries are posted on America 250's website. A 5th grader in Saipan in the northern Mariana Islands won after submitting a drawing of some notable mainland imagery, including the Golden Gate Bridge and a cheeseburger. Dear Mr. Benjamin Franklin, wrote a 7th grader from Winterville, Georgia, in your time, the United States hardly existed. As I am writing this letter, it is almost the semi-quincentennial, and boy, does the U.S. exist now. America's Field Trip is a laudable thing that will produce more memories for a few hundred kids. But as Rios hyped this achievement, I couldn't help but compare this figure with the estimated 120 Iranian children massacred by the U.S. Navy at the Shahara Tayeba Elementary School in Minip, who hadn't been far from my mind the preceding 3 weeks. This wasn't the fault of America 250, of course, but something still felt unseemly about Rios' emphasis on the way that the program had enabled participating children to feel their future for the very first time. She had hung out with the delegation of winners visiting New York, where, along with outings to the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, the children had lunched with the CEO of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, the financial services company sponsoring the program. These are kids who may have otherwise been deprived, who may not have known, she said, what the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation was or what the Federal Reserve did. Now they'd surely never forget. She soon turned to the commission's raison d'etre. If America 250 has a call to action, it's in response to the fact that young Americans are less patriotic than ever, as confirmed by a dispiriting recent Gallup poll. The commission seeks to instill in them a belief in the American dream, and it had found a perfect place to start. What might the youth be feeling bitter about? In a million years, I could not have guessed where this was going. The difficulty undergraduates face in accessing venture capital funding. Enter America's Startup, an initiative facilitated by the commission's founding national innovation partner, Leidos, a defense technologies and IT services contractor based in Reston, Virginia, with a respectably long controversy section on Wikipedia, and which would make $25,000 of funding available to 10 winning teams in a national business idea competition. Think about this, Rios urged. If Mark Zuckerberg would have had this as an undergrad, would that have made a difference? If undergrads found themselves in need of inspiration putting together their pitch decks, they could fire up America's Soundtrack, curated by Emilio Estefan, husband of Gloria, which would be releasing songs through July. The first tranche included a recording of The Battle Hymn of the Republic by the Tabernacle Choir at Temple Square, formerly known as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and a commissioned work by the composer Karen Lefrock, apparently a friend of Kellyanne's, Sober Stuff, but an upcoming drop would include a remastered version of Celebration by Kool and the Gang, one of the biggest downloaded party songs in history, at least according to Rios. Presumably, these songs would play at America's block parties, officially sanctioned celebration zones in a few major cities on the 4th of July weekend. My grasp on the American story seemed more tenuous than ever. America 250 was clearly not going to help me any more than the all-caps messaging on the buildings outside. because of its structure as a bipartisan, consensus-driven organization at the end of a decade of riotous and difficult arguments about the nature of American history, the body established to commemorate the historical birth of the nation could not actually say anything about the nation or its history. It would have to remain in safe territory, and the size of that particular piece of real estate had become very small. Cheap ads remained one of the few things not yet claimed in the national divorce. On my way out of the visitor center, I passed an informational display from Trump's Freedom 250 promising a Great American State Fair on the National Mall that would show the triumph of the American spirit, counter-programming, perhaps, for America 250's block parties. The visual accompaniment to the president's promise of national enjoyment showed two multi-story stone arcades running down the length of the mall. Very classical. Very RETVRN. An internet slang for the online reject modernity, embrace tradition movement. Thronged with crowds. Fireworks. An enormous Ferris wheel dwarfing the Capitol Dome. A proud white father directing his wife and daughter into the crowd and the future. My eye caught on the text, "What was for sale in the arcades?" on the left, in the telltale dreamlike half-words of an AI image generator, California, food, GQTSCI. On the right side, FRNNTE, gifts, Florida. The next day, I maneuvered past Daniel Patrick Moynihan Place, and through the maze-like halls of the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center to the headquarters of America 250 for a meeting with Rios. The office was clean, expansive, patriotically decorated with the organization's swag, but at least on the day I visited, otherwise empty, with a long line of shared desks adjacent to a sitting area in which the only inhabitants were me and a friendly PR minder from the firm Edelman, whose Wikipedia controversy section is considerably longer than Litos's. Rios stressed that the office was considerably cheaper than the one arranged by her predecessor, a Taj Mahal in Northern Virginia. Rios, amiable, practiced, and forcefully exuberant, took a seat across from me in a bright conference room with ergonomic chairs. Naturally, she is personally responsible for neither Washington's dysfunction nor, really, the troubles of America 250. Nor is she responsible for assuaging my doubts about the country. Rios took the job at a difficult time in her life, she was willing to tell me. The only reason she'd lasted so long, she said, is because she grew up in a family of 9 children. When she told me that simply getting the field trip program off the ground was tremendously difficult, I believed her. Rios, like the other members of the commission, is a representative of a political moment that now feels like it belongs to the distant past. In 2008, she was one of the best and brightest that washed into D.C. with the Obama campaign, when a fresh crop of Americans gained entry to elite circles. While many of them have since been exiled, some found themselves stuck behind in Vichy, Washington. Rios had heard that she might be the last Biden appointee left in town. She has a personal story that I can imagine being upheld as an example of the country's greatness in Obama's rhetorical patter. She was born the daughter of a seasonal migrant worker at the Hunt's Tomato Factory in Hayward, California. Her hardworking single mother, with the help of the local Catholic parish, sent all 9 kids to college. Rios went to Harvard and worked as an economic development consultant in California before her assistance to Obama's campaign earned her the job of treasurer for 7 years, when her signature went out on every greenback. Rios identifies as fiscally conservative, socially liberal, and boasts that she also helped organize Harvard's 350th birthday. For her, the bicentennial brings to mind her 5th grade summer when the Freedom Train, a mobile museum on wheels, stopped in Oakland. She associates the patriotic season with her immense gratitude for her mother and with the optimism that accompanied her burgeoning awareness that she was a real American, part of the tribe. She feels this just as strongly today, she insisted. I want as many Americans as possible to feel like this is a land of opportunity all over again, she said. This is why we have programs like America's Startup, right? America 250's effort to find the next innovator, next entrepreneur, or indeed the next 10 of them, was the central expression of its mission. About the Gallup poll, why did Rios think young people were so down on the country? It's a lot of things, she said. Then she asked me a question. What happened in 2007 that basically turned our world upside down? I didn't have to think. For my microgeneration, the disillusionment crept in with the savage failure of the Iraq War. But the financial crash, I answered, was a more lasting lesson in how the world works, a lesson whose consequences are still being borne by the young. She shook her head. The iPhone, she said, holding up her own. Whether it was that or the social media revolution the smartphone enabled, it had to be conceded that technology is disruptive, and, as Rios put it, that it had changed the sense of connection young people felt toward others. The pandemic, of course, didn't help. It was Rios's aspiration that America 250 would bring that hope back. I had no doubt that phones were making kids sad, because mine hadn't been great for my mental health either. But that fact did tend to sharpen the question of whether we needed more startups. The commissioners, on the other hand, did not seem to be suffering from social media anemia. They had succeeded in keeping politics off the table completely, she said. In fact, no ideology, religious or otherwise, has entered into any of our conversations. But America, it happens, is a pretty ideological construct, and Americans have been arguing about that construct for 250 years, a process we call politics. These debates about our history and the purpose of the country have been particularly heated and searching over the past 15 years. Without being able to engage meaningfully in those debates, the commission would have to settle for saying nothing. I asked Rios whether there were certain things the commission couldn't talk about, given the nature of its mandate. I'm not a historian, she said. I love history. But for me to dictate what should or shouldn't be part of our history was never in our purview. Nor should it be, in my opinion. It was the job of each American to make meaning about their country. But there's no doubt in my mind that absolutely we are the greatest country on earth. Absolutely. And I feel that every day. This inability to weigh in on core questions about what it means to be an American helped lead to the other notable structural decision regarding America 250. Responsibility for making meaning has been effectively block granted to the states. We made the decision to empower the states to make sure that their stories were told, Rios explained. The commission takes credit for the organization of 56 state and territorial commissions and deserves some, although states with long histories were probably going to create them anyway. The overwhelming majority of events that maintain some connection to America 250 are organized by state-level or local commissions and listed on the National Commission's website in a clunky database. These include high-profile events like the anniversary of Boston's Evacuation Day and trivial ones like a regularly scheduled cooking class in El Paso celebrating Irish potato soup, Chinese dumplings, and cocoa. Leaving the thorny questions to the locals is, in one sense, a no-brainer acknowledgement that Alabama and Massachusetts have different relationships to federal authority. But it's a little strange if you think about it. Not a single state was born on July 4, 1776. What happened that day was the creation of a federal compact. That compact maintained a patent office and sent us to the moon and did other notable things. But its real value throughout the 250 years in which it had to be defended, reformed, and expanded, sometimes at the expense of blood and suffering, is that it could, at its best, liberate Americans from tyrannical conditions created by state governments. To put it in a less egg-headed way, one of the Obama-era rhetorical kernels that has outlived the revelation that the arc of history is more of a squiggle was his proclamation that we have never been a collection of red states and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America. This was a piece of puffery that happened to accord with a long-standing and actually pretty important argument about the nature of the country. On the occasion of that country's birthday, America 250's position is that there are states, and then there is cool in the gang. You are listening to readings from the July 2026 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I had hoped to stick with America 250 in the run-up to the 4th of July, but it didn't seem there was much to do with them. I had a backup plan, though. On my way out, I told Rios that I was thinking of heading to northwestern Pennsylvania to check out one of Freedom 250's Freedom Trucks, mobile museums funded partially with money appropriated from her organization. Here, her strained exuberance keyed up a bit. Haven't seen one. Saw the plans. She was sure I would have a nice time. Leaving Washington, I realized I had set a trap for myself. My editor had specifically instructed me not to return with a piece that was too po-faced, which I took as a warning to avoid heavy-handed metaphors, dim-witted ruminations about the angel of history, excessive invocation of patriotic symbolism, dour warnings about the national direction, midnight trips to the Lincoln Memorial to seek moral counsel, and so forth. This is a task at which I had already failed, and was about to fail again. It turned out that the Airbnb I was planning to stay in, en route to Pittsburgh, a cabin without plumbing, whose owner advertised the usefulness of his properties for Bigfoot hunting expeditions, happened to be located outside Shepherdston, West Virginia, established in 1762. The cabin sat on the not-so-mighty banks of the Potomac, looking north toward Antietam Creek and the great slaughter of September 17, 1862, and on the site of the Battle of O'Teller's Ford, fought 2 days later. This was dangerous territory for a magazine man. I could do a lot of portentous thinking. Hems, haws, as the river runs, the works. But I didn't much want to, which was odd, because I think portentously about American history most of the time. 2 days in Washington had bummed me out, which surprised me to the extent that it reflected a desire within myself, stronger than I had realized, to feel a less complicated love of country again, and it was manifesting now as a kind of mental block. It was true that I had previously drawn a rough plan to hit up a few historical sites in between Washington, northwestern Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, my final destination, to see whether it would be cathartic or otherwise shake some feeling loose. And it did, a little, maybe. Gettysburg was deeply moving, and I teared up in the cemetery, even though I knew from Gary Wills that the older memorials to Lincoln's address had been placed in the wrong spot. More often, I had the unsettling sense of being out of time, of eternal recurrence, of the piling of things. At times, the sense of disconnection was merely funny. The most prominent monument in the vicinity of Valley Forge, it turns out, is a casino. And I overheard a tourist at Harper's Ferry tell his friend that John Brown was notable because he was a member of the Black Panther Party. At other moments, it felt more like the accumulated weight of dead generations. At Antietam, just below the cornfield, I noticed a shade of pink granite that I associate with the Texas State Capitol, where I reported for some years. Shaped like a headstone, the memorial faced a much larger and more decorative monument for the Brooklyn 14th, a regiment formed by abolitionists from where I now mostly live. The headstone, a memorial to Texans who served the Confederacy, was erected in 1964, which is to say the state missed the 100-year anniversary of the battle itself, but it did remember to to put it up in the year that Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. The Texas Brigade, the Stone said, suffered an 82.3% casualty rate. Good, I thought. It should have been 100. I had to admit this was not morally healthy. Then, in the summer of 2024, the last Democratic president's brains leaked out into America's living rooms on primetime television, I made peace with the fact that Trump would be coming back. I held off on reading the news and went to read about the parts of American history I knew the least about instead. What I read about antebellum America, like the useless Fists First Congress of the 1840s and 1850s, was helpful in understanding the present, but the very fact that it reminded me of the present was unpleasant. I dead-ended with the Gilded Age for similar reasons. Over and over again, I fell into reading about the Civil War and Reconstruction. This, I rationalized, was because it was in some way reassuring to read about a period during which half of the country became polarized, often against their intentions, in the service of a cause that was truly good. But I felt a darker impulse, too. It was soothing to vicariously experience the other half of the country getting smashed. Perhaps this wasn't morally healthy either, but it was hard to upbraid myself too much given the countless ways in which the conservatives I follow for my work as a journalist had themselves been openly fantasizing about smashing the values of, and sometimes the bodies of, my half. When Alex Pretty was executed by federal agents, say, or a Texas politician warned that America was turning into Rhodesia, I could read about Theodore Parker's sermons or Sherman burning plantations in Georgia. It was a necessary indulgence, but one I may have been drawing on too often. Across the Pennsylvania border, the signs began to proliferate. In a town that appeared economically ruined, an electronic billboard flashing faces of Americans killed by migrants was broken up by an ominous warning next to the decapitated head of the Statue of Liberty lying in a field of flames. Democrats want to destroy America. I had been hoping to find some kind of indication that the country was something more than a set of unresolvable debates about the nature of liberty sublimated into a kind of national death drive, but it hadn't yet materialized. This will to violence would be easier to accept if it were only directed inward, but the size of the arsenal the nation had acquired as a result of the Second World War meant that it always had the power to hurt others through incompetence or spite. Exercising the prerogatives of citizenship meant a wearying, lifelong battle to mitigate harm, one that would invariably fail, as the experiences of one generation faded out of living memory, and another one picked up the same arguments and same ideas to reconfigure them in new ways. The schoolchildren of Minab had been close to mind in part because of my strong and difficult memories of touring the still operational Shirayama Elementary School in Nagasaki, which had been 500 meters from the hypo center. I wondered, in the carrying out of the eternal recurrence, how many more schools I would live to see my country bomb. Slippery Rock, which for 2 days in late March served as the temporary home of one of the Trump administration's freedom trucks, is about an hour's drive north of Pittsburgh. It feels considerably more vibrant than some of its neighboring towns, in large part because of Slippery Rock University, a state college, the fifth best value in Pennsylvania, according to the billboards, that triples the population when classes are in session and provides trade to a couple of trashy college bars and a sandwich shop. But there are also farming and mining jobs, both under pressure, and charming bed and breakfasts. One of the town's sources of pride is that George Washington passed through in 1753, when he was an officer during the lead-up to what Americans call the French and Indian War. According to local legend, the town owes its name to a nearby river ford. During the war, the sturdy footwear of Washington and his troops allowed them to cross safely, whereas the moccasins of their Indian pursuers sent them tumbling into the creek. Esmith, this is interesting in that it reverses the typical direction of aggression. Washington was here on his way to kick off a brawl with the French and their native allies in the Ohio River Valley. English settlers wanted to ensure they could keep pushing west, and most tribes Washington encountered knew perfectly well what that meant for them. The Iroquois would come to call him Hanadagayas, the town devourer. This was bloody country, but pretty quaint these days when the blood was being shed elsewhere. On that Friday, about 1 month into the war with Iran, the price of a barrel of West Texas Intermediate had finished trading at more than $100, defeating what many suspected to be federal financial engineering to keep it below the threshold and relieve pressure on the president. At about the same time, Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps had destroyed a vital and expensive E-3 AWACS aircraft, one of 16 left in service, while it was parked at an airbase deep inside Saudi Arabia. A number of other American military bases in the Middle East had effectively been evacuated because they were considered indefensible. As if any more were needed, these were additional signs that we might not be the only ones to determine the conditions under which we celebrate Independence Day. At the Apple Butter Inn, a brick farmhouse that dates to 1844, the owner bemoaned that Canadian snowbirds, once a mainstay, had stopped visiting since the president threatened to send the Marines across Niagara Falls. She'd picked up a new source of business, though. Slippery Rock is a half hour away from the town of Butler, and admirers of the president had started to make pilgrimage to the grounds of the farm show where the Maximin leader bested the forces of death only 2 years earlier. Confused by this, I went to see what there was to see and encountered an inaccessible fenced-in compound next to an airstrip and a Mazda dealership. Something was a little fishy in Slippery Rock. You wouldn't believe how much bitterness and meanness you can get in a town this size, one resident told me. In my experience, this is a pretty common sentiment in small towns. Familiarity breeds contempt, as they say. But I kept catching stray comments about the mayor's flag, and the peculiar conditions that had descended on Slippery Rock over the past decade, in much the same order as they had descended on the country at large. The town had historically been fairly cleanly split between Democrats and Republicans, but Pennsylvania as a whole seemed to be leaning rightward after Trump's first victory. In 2017, a graduate student working at the town's Main Street brewpub named John David Longo decided to run for mayor as a Republican, pledging to make Slippery Rock great. Longo won and has been reelected twice, but this is a purple town, not a deep red one. Last November, he received just 52% of the vote. This might suggest that Longo would be inclined to adopt a conciliatory, soft-touch approach, but that has very much not been the case. On his Instagram, happy photos of his family living the American dream are interspersed with violent admonitions about the forces lurking in his own community and seeking to destroy him. One post from February features a self-portrait, to which Longo added ominous, discordant music and the grain of a CCTV camera, like a prisoner in a horror movie. "Some days you don't rise," the text reads. "You're dragged forward by the version of you that refuses to let them kill you." The caption under the post is even darker. "Leftists want you dead. They want your sons imprisoned, your wives ostracized, your daughters raped." The previous post is a perfectly sweet picture of his daughter celebrating her first birthday. There appeared to be some psychology, with a capital P, at work here. When I met Longo at a downtown coffee shop, he was wearing a sharp suit and a Stars and Stripes necktie. He was friendly and courteous and seemed under the impression that I was MAGA too. "I think you and I speak the same language, maybe politically," he said. Curious about what he meant, I remembered that I had recently predicted on X that we'd never again see a president as funny as Trump after he invited a Saudi investment conference to talk sex with him. What, I wondered, did Longo and I share as countrymen beyond contempt for many of our fellow countrymen? In a way, I found him easier to understand than Rios. But mutual contempt was perhaps an even less promising foundation to build a country on than merchandising. Longo's story is sort of like Rios's, although it's harder to imagine it being related in Obama's voice. His beloved father, soon to become an American citizen, was raised in a concrete bunker in Puglia, the heel of the boot. Longo himself hailed from Beaver County, Pennsylvania, where he grew up looking dreamily at a 30-by-60-foot flag atop a 120-foot pole that had been planted in the town of Rochester by the Flags Across America program back in 2001. An uncle gave him a copy of Thomas Paine's Common Sense when he was 14. A patriot was born. After graduating from college, Longo joined the Marines and did a tour in Afghanistan. He then enrolled in Slippery Rock University, got his master's in education, bought a house, and married a cop. His election at the age of 27 earned him a disproportionate amount of national attention, and he was soon developing a profile far above what might have been expected of a borough leader in Butler County. He acted as a campaign surrogate for the president in 2024, and currently serves as the Pennsylvania chair for the MAGA-aligned America First Policy Institute, a Beltway think tank. The national love helped make up for the doubt he faced at home, which felt in some way persecutory. He was still a little bitter about his opponents, who during his first campaign had argued that he was too young to be mayor. "It didn't matter that I was a homeowner," he told me. "I'd been to war and been to Afghanistan, right? None of those things counted." His election was the first taste this community got of MAGA republicanism, and they had a hard time adjusting. He seemed a little proud of this. Longo is also proud of keeping taxes steady and reducing municipal debt. But by far, the most important part of his mayoral tenure has been the growth in the number of patriotic symbols in Slippery Rock, an effort that really took off in 2020 when left-wing protesters were in the streets in the big cities and good Americans were trapped inside amid lockdown orders. Case in point, the town had no organized 4th of July festival before Longo's mayoralty, but it now held them every summer. This July, Slippery Rock will have 3 separate fireworks launch points. On social media, Longo has made a solemn vow: Independence Day, every day. But even more important is the flag. Back during COVID, Longo was chatting with a local businessman, trying to brainstorm what he called some kind of feel-good, you know, some commercial stimulation, anything. Then an idea struck him. "Well, I love flags. What if Slippery Rock had an even bigger version of the flag that once inspired him as a child in Beaver County?" The flagpole that his administration debuted in July 2023 is 150 feet tall, made with Pennsylvania steel, sunk in Pennsylvania sandstone, and placed at the highest point in town, 1,400 feet above sea level. The flag itself is 40 by 80 feet, and cost more than $100,000 between the installation and money set aside for future operating expenses. According to Longo's calculations, Slippery Rock's flag may well be the largest, highest-flying one in 130 square miles. It's visible for many miles during the day and spotlit at night. "Usually we don't raise it till Memorial Day," Longo told me, but it was flying now in honor of the Freedom Truck. When the flag was first unveiled, he invited America 250 to send a representative to give a speech. An envoy arrived and delivered some brief remarks. But subsequent efforts to involve the organization in celebrating what is, he reminded me, the largest, highest flying flag in the region have gone unanswered. He has a low opinion of the commission, which he says was hijacked by the Biden administration. America 250 state partner, Pennsylvania 250, the mayor told me, had been similarly hijacked by Governor Josh Shapiro's administration. Longo registered his disgust at the partisanship of the semi-quincentennial commemorations at the state and federal levels, but a few minutes later expressed wonderment that dissenters in Slippery Rock suspected his own Independence Day plans of being partisan. The American people were, it seemed, failing at every level to understand that they were united. Longo and I walked to a parking lot across the street from the dinky Dachshund tattoo parlor where the Freedom Truck was parked. As a concept, the truck seemed to be inspired by the Freedom Train of the 1976 Bicentennial, which carried founding documents and other historical exhibits around the country. The train had its origins in 1947 as a tool for patriotic education in the early stage of the Cold War, when it was pulled by GE's state-of-the-art red, white, and blue Alco diesel-electric engine. Both trains made a considerable cultural splash, in part because they carried things people wanted to see. Footnote number 2. The Freedom Train had its own march and its own advertising firm, but its efforts to unify the country were not entirely successful. It occasioned, in its first incarnation, an upbeat song by Irving Berlin. The song is a train song where the engineer is Uncle Sam, performed by Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters, and a downbeat satire by Langston Hughes, recorded by Paul Robeson. If my children ask me, Daddy, please explain why there's Jim Crow stations for the Freedom Train. It had an even rockier run during the Bicentennial, partly because America's rail infrastructure was in a state of collapse. Nevertheless, its stops were well attended. Continuing with the article, the Freedom Truck, by contrast, is a museum that contains nothing old or original. It is a semi-trailer whose external walls can be expanded just a bit to create standing room for wall panels full of text and a few large interactive screens. Despite this, the Trump administration has weighted the trucks with great expectations. The Federal Institute of Museum and Library Services, which is partially funding the trucks, announced that they would be a powerful blow against woke. Instead of telling the great American story, many cultural institutions have been hijacked by advocates of divisive social theories, the acting head of the IMLS, Keith E. Sonderling, wrote in The Hill. Big rigs and the open highway would chart the course back to sanity. The reality was a little underwhelming. The famous 1796 Gilbert Stuart portrait of Washington, the town devourer, his hand solemnly outstretched, hung in a frame near the entrance. Jump scare. It came to life. "My name is George Washington. You may have heard of me," said the AI video at the start of its 3-minute loop. War is a terrible thing, but sometimes it is necessary. Such was our War of Independence. By nurturing the sacred fire of liberty burning within us, George was able to overcome threats to the country, just as the viewer could today. If he or she believes strongly enough, the fate of liberty is in your hands. It all felt a little Disney. AI George was freaky, firmly in the uncanny valley. Part of the problem was the flat, affectless voice, which we could barely hear anyway. The falseness of the medium, though, jibed with the falseness of most attempts throughout American history to make sense of this enormous strange man, Most folks weren't lingering on AI George anyway. It wasn't interactive. They were spending more time with the other screens. A quiz in the front part of the truck challenged attendees to learn whether they were a patriot or a loyalist, and it laid it on pretty thick. Your town establishes a committee of correspondence, which spreads information about American resistance to the British, read question 6. The first option was to join eagerly to help spread patriot ideas. The other was to report the activity to British officials as suspicious. Attendees carefully considered their options. Everyone ended up a patriot. At the rear of the truck was another screen where attendees could add their own signature to the Declaration of Independence, and yet another that played a taped message from President Trump. The text panels on the rest of the walls were mostly potted histories of each major step of the war, all pretty dense and easy to slide past. There used to be more screens, Dean Shirley, one of the docents, told me. 5 iPads, but one of them came loose and flattened a toddler, and the powers that be pulled the devices before any more of America's youth could fall in the great struggle for independence. It was unfortunate, he said, that a single parent's negligence had prevented so many others from pursuing a patriotic education. Shirley, a jovial man with a red beard, had been on the road with the Freedom Trucks for months, first with truck number 2 in Nashville for the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, then with truck number 3 in South Carolina. This was now truck number 4, and the best attended stop he'd worked, with more than 800 visitors through the door, with 4 hours left to go. Hearing this, Longo beamed. We are running out of time, so I will complete this story in the next episode. You have been listening to Happy Fucking Birthday, An Exhausted America Turns 250 by Christopher Hooks from the July 2026 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Thanks so much for listening today, and I hope that you'll join me again next time.